Talk given Sunday, 28th January, 1973. You have often heard me say that the death of the body means the complete dissolution of the whole psychophysical organism, and with it all self-consciousness, which is ordinarily expressed as I am I, vanishes altogether. There is no such thing as some sort of immaterial entity which one would like to call the soul or the ego or whatever it is, which survives as an identifiable entity. With the death of the pattern, which is the psychophysical organism as such, identifiability vanishes altogether, because there is no entity separate from other entities to identify. This is rather a difficult matter to understand to start with, and even more difficult to be free of our cherished beliefs and convictions that there is something which is the permanent me which survives. The Buddha taught this very, very clearly. There is no such thing as the survival of personality. No such thing whatsoever. Nor is there annihilation. Our difficulty comes here, that if there is no such thing as annihilation, then obviously I survive. No, I don't survive. There is no annihilation. The totality remains the totality. But the particular patterns, the different particular patterns which compose the totality, disappear completely as identifiable entities. And the I concept is associated entirely with the self-consciousness which is manifest in each one of us whilst alive as a separate person. Now, all the great religions, including Buddhism, have also not merely discussed, but affirmed very positively that there is the deathless state. That's the Buddhist phrase. And all the other religions have used the word immortality. Within ourselves, there is this extraordinary longing for immortality. What then is the meaning of immortality? And what are the implications of that meaning? Is it implied that there is an immortality for me, an identifiable entity here, but existing still in a peculiar way as an entity in the immaterial state? And to begin with, let us clearly understand that none of the great religions have really taught the immortality of the particular me, the existential being, despite what all the theologians have said. If you look into the original teachings themselves, there is no such thing as the immortality of a separate me. Think of it this way too. If there was the immortality of separate me's, would we have a universe which is a one total reality? Philosophically, we can't. It's not possible. This is too austere a thing, a fact, for the intellect to accept. It reels before it, in fact. And, of course, there is the tremendous force of our own personal longing for immortality. Consider also the fact that all the theologies, even including Buddhism in this case, have talked in terms of heaven and hell. In the case of the theistic religions, the strictly theistic religions, they have presented a permanent heaven and a permanent hell after death. Assuming this were true, how would I, who long for immortality and want it to be the fact, feel if I discovered at the other end that the scales were weighted against me and I was sentenced to eternal misery, hell? Would I enjoy my immortality? Would I care to grasp it? Or would I strive to get out of it? See, one has to consider all these things very carefully and find out the tricks of the mind. Then we come to know ourselves a little bit better. And yet, we must never forget that the holy ones of all the ages, the great ones who saw the truth, who had become one with the truth, unequivocally affirmed immortality. Let us look into the meaning of immortality. Or at least let us try to look into it. You find these great affirmations throughout all the scriptures. In the Rig Veda you find, for instance, the great Rishi Pragatha in one of the hymns of the eighth book of the Rig Veda affirming, "We have drunk Soma and become immortal. We have attained the light the gods discovered." You find another great Rishi, this time in the ninth book. And this, you may remember, I quoted time before last. Writing, "Place me in that deathless, immortal realm where dwells the king, that is Yama, the son of Vivasvant. Where lucid, place me in that third heaven where lucid worlds are full of light." You find the great Rishi Brihadeva in the 10th book, it's the 120th hymn. He says, "Brihadeva hath thrown open all the doors of light and spoken with Indra, the Lord of Heaven himself, in person. You find in the Avasta, Zarathustra declaring, "Then did I see thee, O Ahura Mazda, as the most bountiful one, when the good mind, the perfected holy mind, completely enfolded me." You find in the Bible statements like this. In Genesis, in the 5th chapter, you find, "And Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, for God took him." It is never said of Enoch that he died, as it is said of all those who precede him in that line which comes down from Seth and goes after Enoch, right up to and including Noah. All of them live so many years and die. But Enoch was not, for God took him. In the second book of Kings, you find that wonderful passage where Elijah and Elisha are walking along, talking together. And at the final stage, whilst they were talking, there appeared the chariot of fire, the horsemen of Israel, and the horses of fire, and the chariot of fire. And Elijah is taken up into heaven by a whirlwind. No death mentioned for Elijah. And then, of course, you have the great statement of the resurrection and ascension of Jesus. And if you look into the Upanishads, you will find numberless statements affirming the realization of immortality. But in the Upanishads, it is openly stated that that realization takes place here and now. And it is the same with the Buddha. Nirvana, the permanent state, the immortal state, is realized here and now. Don't forget that. In the Upanishads, the Kaushitaki Upanishad, for instance, says, "When one perceives that, that meaning Brahman, it is immortality that one finds." The Kena Upanishad says, "When known by an awakening, it is conceived of, it is immortality that one attains." In the Katha Upanishad, at the very end, it is said, "How Nachiketas, having received the whole teaching of yoga from the Lord of Death," that is, Yama, Yamaraja, as he is sometimes called, you see, "having received the teaching of yoga from the Lord of Death, realizes Brahman and attains immortality." In the Mundaka Upanishad, you have a wonderful statement. "He who realizes Brahman, who sees Brahman, becomes very Brahman." Very Brahman, in the same way as in Christianity we use the phrase "very God of very God." He becomes very Brahman. But note further what is said. "He crosses over sin. He crosses over all sorrow." So we find these affirmations, these unequivocal affirmations of immortality. Now, to understand this immortality, let us examine its other face, mortality. From our very earliest days, all our experiences, our thoughts, our moods, the events which take place in our life, are all categorized for us in that system of symbolical sounds which we call words. Every sense stimulus, whether it be a visual one, an audible one, a tactile one, whatever it may be, everything is associated with words which represent the living experience. Now, every word, you will notice, stands for something which comes into being, proceeds, and reaches an end. In other words, something which is born, something which dies. And our entire waking life, as well as our dream state, is composed of an endless succession of words. We are aware of our whole existence in terms of speech thought, thought which is a verbalization of all living experience. We are never free from that. We are aware of the whole universe in terms of that which uprises and which passes away, of birth and death. Now, it is this mode of awareness which characterizes our whole life and living process, which is the meaning of rebirth in the real sense. Here and now, whilst we are alive, we are constantly being born and we constantly die, because we are conscious of our whole life process with which we associate the self, the I. Whatever you are conscious of, you associate with yourself. I felt this, I heard that, I did this, I suffered that, and so forth. We are conscious of our entire life process as a succession of births and deaths. And this is the real meaning of rebirth. Not that utterly mistaken reincarnational concept, which is wishful thinking. Particularly in the Rig Veda, there is no mention whatever of reincarnation. It's a very interesting point. And at least four of the great religions of the world have done extremely well and been very successful in world history without reincarnation. Do bear that in mind. Now, it is this succession of births and deaths in terms of our own consciousness which is what we call samsara. The Indian word samsara is this cycle of births and deaths in our own day-to-day consciousness. And if you will look at it, you will see that by and large, the bulk of it is confined to the life of conflict and confusion and frustration that we experience in connection with food, sex, business, our ambitions, and so on. We are caught up in this miserable round of births and deaths here and now, during the lifetime of the body. But now, through the ages, there have always been those who were in anguish because of this apparently futile, meaningless, restrictive round of births and deaths in consciousness. They chafed at this, and they longed to discover how they could transcend this bondage. Even with all the lovely things, the great things, the noble things in life, they all began, they proceeded, they ended. Death finally claimed everything and everyone. And death is a stark, unanswerable, absolute, inevitable and ineluctable reality. It's the one thing which you can absolutely predict about anything whatsoever which comes into being. One cannot predict what will come into being, but whatsoever does come into being will inevitably die. So these men of old chafed at this. They felt that if only they could break through these thorny bounds of their own ignorance, fling away the fetters of mortality, and triumph over the Lord of Death, they would assuredly realize that ineffable, most worthwhile experience which they regarded as immortality. They were worried with many questions. What is the origin of things? What is the purpose, the meaning of our life? Is there any answer for it? And if you look through all the theologies and philosophies of the world, which have been spun out by intellectual activity, not a single one gives any answer which is worth much. A temporary consolation, yes, possible. But another philosopher arises, another theologian comes along and sweeps away the mortal structure raised by the mind, the confused, the unenlightened mind of philosopher and theologian. Now, these men, and they have existed through the ages, and they exist today, and will continue to exist as long as human beings are on the globe. Those men discovered, through their constant communion with nature, and their longing for close proximity with the creative origin of all things, that a new mode of awareness of their daily existence came into being, with the pacification of the sense functions and the calming down of this violently disturbed ocean of discursive thought. And they discovered that this pacification and calming down came into being because of two indispensable prerequisites which they had succeeded in developing. First and foremost, morality. The purity of everyday life, harmlessness, truthfulness, continence, kindliness, and so on and so on. And the second was that process of looking inwards by which they discovered all the obstructions within their own minds which prevented them from realizing a profounder state. Namely, their prejudices, their preconceptions, their biases, their assumptions, all their beliefs, their convictions, their store of memory of the past, the dead past, according to which they tried to understand the living present, which is an utterly hopeless task. They discovered that all these were the obstructions. They saw that all these obstructions in the mind had to be removed. And so, as the Buddha would have, as the Buddha taught, they did not cling to ideas, beliefs, prejudices, and so forth. Looking at them very, very clearly, they relinquished them altogether with right wisdom. When these two conditions, which are two indispensable prerequisites, the purity of the whole psychophysical organism and the daily life, and the freedom from all the defilements and the illusions and delusions of the mind, was achieved, they discovered that they were aware of the world, of this everyday world, in a totally different way. They were, in fact, entering what we would commonly call the deep states of consciousness. Now, you know what happens when one enters into one of the deep states and cannot go any further. One comes back to the ordinary state of consciousness. If one is in one of the deep states and does not come back, sometimes one falls asleep, like the disciples of Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane. And you remember how deeply he felt it in those simple words of his, "Could you not watch with me for a single hour?" Often in these very deep states where, remember, the process of building up thought forms has ceased, the impress of the transcendent upon the mind is interpreted afterwards, when one comes back to ordinary consciousness, as having seen a vision, or having been given a message by the angel of the Lord, or something like that. One talks of having seen the Lord, of talking with Krishna, or Moses, or Zarathustra, or whoever it is. And in every case, the entity mentioned, I'm just using the word entity for conveying the point merely, the entity mentioned is an entity which is a thought form created in the mind of the speaker by the conditioning which his particular upbringing, his culture, his religion, and his race have presented him. This is what happens. Some of these states are quite extraordinary states. Peaceful, deep, profound, sublime, elevating. But in none of these states is there the full realization of the immortal. Because in every one of these states, there is a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending. And it is associated afterwards with expression in terms of finite and limited thought and speech. Every one of these is still within the realm of death, of mortality. Time and again, the holy ones attained a very close proximity to the ultimate reality. But it would end like the falling apart of two lovebirds in mid-air. And back they would come to this all too solid state of unlove, this distracting cacophony of the speech-thought activity which represents the process of mortality. Now, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, Adam falls from grace and is successively redeemed by Enoch, Elijah, and Jesus. Those are instances which are actually mentioned in the Bible. Enoch was not, for God took him, no death associated with him. Elijah in the chariot of fire, no death associated with him. And with Jesus, the resurrection and ascension, presented in this instance as the conquest over death, the defeat of death. Just as in the Katha Upanishad, you get the extraordinary example of Nachiketas. In the Iranian tradition, you have the account of Yima, who rises to the supreme heights of communion with Ahura-Mazda, who grants him worldly lordship, kingship in fact. Yima is the one who, in legendary Iranian history, is talked of as Jamshid. Those of you who have read some of this old stuff will remember the name, Jamshid, the great king. But Yima falls through pride. And in the Avastan scriptures, in the Zamyad Yast, it is stated that then the kingly glory and the majesty of the Lord was seen to fly away from him. Yima's fall is redeemed by Zarathustra and his teaching. Now, in the Rig Vedic teaching, there is no fall. We have the name Yama. See, the Rig Vedic people and the Iranian people had languages which are very closely allied, and you get the same type of name. Yima for the Iranians and Yama for the Rig Vedic Indians. Now, in the case of Yama, there is no fall. In the Rig Veda, it is said of Yama that he chooses death, abandons his body and passes into the inner world, and is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. Yama becomes the lord of death, the master of death, not to be confused with Antaka or Mara or Mrityu, the death dealer. That is quite different. Yama becomes the master of death. He is known as Yamaraja. Now, let us take the first statement. Yama chooses death. What does that mean? Very simply, he dies to all worldliness. There's a complete metanoia. He turns away from the type of awareness which characterizes the worldling. And the worldling is one who grasps at the things of the world, whether they be things material or things spiritual. He turns away from all that. He dies completely, in other words, to the awareness of existence as an entity world in which there is only a succession of births and deaths. And obviously this implies the indispensable preliminaries of purification and of that mindfulness, which means the emptying of the mind of all concepts and ideas and so forth. This is the meaning of Yama choosing death. Now, when one chooses death and realizes it, here and now whilst one is alive, one has abandoned the body. Which means, the word body in this context stands for everything which comes into being, proceeds and dies. In other words, he abandons mortality, the mortal mode of consciousness. And he passes into the inner world. Now this inner world is not the world of ecstatic experiences and visions and sublime ideas and whatnot and so on. It doesn't mean that at all. All of them, however wonderful they are, however great the authority of the saints and so forth may be, they all belong to the realm of mortality. This inner world is one in which the whole process of the movement of discursive thought is completely stilled. Now be very careful. The stilling of the stream of discursive thought does not mean that you will cease to think at all. That's quite mistaken. Discursive thought will still go on in a totally different manner. It will be a stream of thought which merely gives you the correct picture of the whole of the becoming process as you experience it from moment to moment, but that stream of discursive thought is completely dissociated from all grasping and attachment on the one hand, from all aversion and violence on the other hand. Now, when the stream of discursive thought has become completely transformed like that, which means the real stilling of the usual flow of discursive thought, and you have ceased to be aware of existence in the mode of mortality, in what manner are you aware of existence? Because you are fully awake here and now. You see, in that state where there is no grasping and attachment on the one hand, no aversion and violence on the other hand, in that state there is the perfect inner poise. There is the state of perfect awareness of that which is, without any sort of interference or misinterpretation of that which is. Now, when you experience something like this, you will find that you are experiencing the true silence. Not only that, you will find that there is no sense of birth and death in succession of separate, discrete events and processes in your own mind. You are aware in terms of as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. You are free of the tyranny of the unidirectional flow of time from past to present to future. In other words, psychological time will have become completely at one with chronological time, which means that the burden of memory is completely out. There is complete attention, complete awareness in the immediate now, which is the eternal now. Because the now is non-moving. It is here. Everlastingly here. And in this stilling of the flow of discursive thought, this utter transcendence of succession, the cycle of births and deaths, as we talked of a little while ago, is the full experience and meaning of immortality, non-mortality. Now this is something which can happen only here and now whilst you are alive. In this state, which if you like you may call superconsciousness, I used to use the term superconsciousness for many, many years, but I prefer now to use the word transconsciousness. For the very simple reason that the word consciousness, and quite justifiably, is associated with discriminative consciousness. But when you discriminate, you separate, inevitably you must, this particular thing from that particular thing. That is to say, you separate this manifestation of mortality from that manifestation of mortality. So a super consciousness would only do that in a super degree. But this transconsciousness is this word transconsciousness may perhaps convey the reality a little bit better when you have transcended the alternation of birth-death. And it is not as if it is a stream. It is all here and now, in a dynamic poise, wherein the totality in its immensity is wholly concentrated in the no thing, which is the immeasurable point here now. These are very, very deep and very difficult things. Don't strain with the intellect to grasp them. If the feel of it can touch the quiet mind and heart, then it will be a seed which will come to fruition if you will let it. Now in that state of trans consciousness, there is no God present. That is to say, our petty little conceptions which we label God. The God of our conceptions is a mortal thing. It is not the transcendent reality. Consider what has happened to all the conceived and pictured and presented and talked of gods through the millions of years that man has been on the globe? Where are they? They have all gone into limbo. How wonderfully it is put in the twilight of the gods when Valhalla falls burning. They all disappear. They are man's conceptions. And man's conceptions are the impurity of the mind. There is no time and space in that state of transconsciousness, because time and space are the final, ultimate constrictors of reality. They are responsible for bringing about limitation, particularity, and finitude to our consciousness. Now, this transconscious state is the one that has been spoken of in so many different ways. All those different affirmations in the scriptures which I mentioned earlier, those in the Rig Veda, the Avastha, those in the Bible, those in the Upanishads, and so on. This is what they mean. Enoch was not, for God took him. In that transconsciousness, there is no I, the separate I. The thou and I duality is completely out. There is only it, the absolute. Elijah in a chariot of fire, taken up by a whirlwind into heaven. The resurrection and the ascension of Jesus. The statement in the Aitareya Upanishad that Vamadeva, the Holy One, ascended aloft and became immortal. Nachiketas realizing immortality. The statement by Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, that whilst we are here, we may know this. Those who know it not go to sorrow only. But those who know it realize immortality. This transconscious realization lies at the very heart of the enlightenment of the Buddha. Take away this from the enlightenment, and you will find that all the rest will fall down. Again and again, the Buddha stresses the entry into the profound states of consciousness in the various jhanas and samapatis. And what is the end point? The complete cessation of all perception and feeling. And the complete cessation of perception and feeling means that the particularized formulation in thought pictures and in verb and in words is at a complete end. You yourself are completely enlightened. You are the awakened one then, because in that state of being totally awakened, your that mysterious sensitivity, which is transcendent mind in you yourself, is fully active, unhampered by your own particular ideas, desires, conceptions, and so forth. So you see, this, as far as I have ever seen in my lifetime, lies at the center of the whole of the religious life and the fulfillment of the religious life.